right. Really excited about this today. Good longtime buddy of mine, street broker turned global broker. We got Ward, the Warden Richmond, on here today, vice chairman for Colliers and the logistics guru. So, Ward, thank you for being here today. And
great to be here, my brother.
Yeah, excited to do this. So,
I love the podcast studio.
Yeah, thank you. We, you know, it took us a while to kind of get this set up. We, it's funny, we wanted to start this earlier in the year last year, but we were just like, we wanted to get all this perfect before we did it. And so we finally got it. And it's funny, at the beginning of the first fourth quarter, we were all setting our goals. I was like, we're going to record 10 podcasts. And Isabel's like, I don't think you're going to get that done. And we started knocking them out. So
yeah, you are.
It's good. So
I like listening.
Yeah.
I have a podcast. Did you know that?
I did know that.
I asked you to be on it. You haven't been on mine yet, but I'm here first. So I'm excited.
You're a better friend than I.
Yeah, I guess so. You don't want to drive to East Dallas, but I drove to Plano. So what it comes down to.
We will book my time on your episode.
I want to record it here before we leave. So your equipment.
We can record it here.
Yeah.
We'll just be easy. That.
Yeah. Let's come back.
We'll let some time bake after this one and then have some new stuff to talk about. Or we'll do it when you want.
I want to get all the same equipment for mine. It's very impressive. Good to be here. And I think podcasting is the best way to market in commercial real estate today. That's my thoughts on it. It's not why I do it, not why I really started it, but it's turned out to be that way.
I think marketing is with the internet and social media and everything now, you have a real way to be omnipresent in today's world. And I think with podcasting too, it just deepens relationships with people you already have or people you don't necessarily have. And then it just opens other doors for a lot of other things, you know? And I've had tons of brokers reach out to me. Hey, we love the broker one. Like, you know, we love hearing the stories of all these top brokers and how they do their business. And then we've had people reach out to us to be like, hey, we want to talk to y'all about placing equity with you, you know, and stuff like that. So there's a lot of things that come from it that you don't plan on it happening, but it does. So
it's like I did like triple down on LinkedIn in 2017, really. And everyone's like, you're Mr. LinkedIn, you know, because not that many people were using LinkedIn the way they do today back then. And it's funny because now, I mean, I just don't even, people still say that to me and I'm not even using LinkedIn at the same, like I may check in once every other week or something on there. And then the podcast happens, but people are like, how do you make money off LinkedIn? And it's like, yeah, but it's not like someone hits a button, but it's, you build the omnipresence your brand up, your personality gets out there. So people, that works on LinkedIn, but podcast is like 100x because then if people listen to it, then they get to know you and in a way, like they're hanging out with you, you know.
Well, you know,
at a dinner or bar or something, and they just get to know your personality while we get to talk with our good friends and people that inspire us and learn something every time. It's just awesome.
No, it's, we're in sales at the end of the day, right? You're in sales.
Everyone's in sales, right?
And what gets people to buy from you is the know, like, and trust factor. Well, if you've already made 20 impressions on somebody before you've even actually spoken to them, it's kind of a lot easier, you know? So I think that's what, I think commercial real estate is very slow to change. You know, it's a lot of old guard type people. So social media and stuff like that is never really, you know, I think there's still a big opportunity in there for a lot of people to grow that platform and it's just about providing value. It's kind of like providing value and documenting your journey is really what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of people can make up some stuff. You know, I've gotten active on Twitter in the retweet community. I like that stuff a lot.
I can't get into Twitter, but it seems super valuable.
It is. I noticed that it seems to be a lot more, I don't know how to say this without being, I don't know, kind of sounding arrogant, but a lot more intellectual people in a way. I don't know if it's because you have to like really write something because someone's going to burn your ass if you write something stupid, you know, and you have to like actually think through the thought. It's funny. I was looking the other day. There's this
one. That's why I don't do it. Yeah. No, it makes sense.
I was looking at this guy the other day. He's some internet guru raising money to buy stuff. And I went and looked at his Twitter feed. You know, he has 700,000 Instagram followers, right? But I go look at his Twitter feed and no one engages with any of his tweets. And it makes me think, well, all the people that actually know about real estate know that this guy's totally full of shit. So it was just kind of, and I looked at a couple other guys like him and I was like, they get zero engagement on Twitter.
And then go look. I know how to tell if someone has fake Instagram followers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And you just go and look at their likes and their comments and you see where they're coming from and you can pretty much tell they're bots on 90% of the people with that type of a following unless you know them.
Yeah.
Like, unless you've actually heard of them and it's some random person with 500,000 followers, it's bullshit. Am I allowed to cuss on here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No. And so I agree. Like I looked at this one guy I know and he claims to have 350,000 followers and he puts up a post and there's like 5 comments and 7 likes.
Yeah.
And then I go look at another guy that I know really has 350,000 followers. There's like 200 comments.
100%. I'm
like, this is so obvious.
Yeah. I always glance at that whenever I see someone like, oh, I mean, it's easy. You just look at one of their posts, like fake followers.
Yeah. But no, I think social media, but I do think podcasting has been, it's the most fun too, right? Yeah. It's very organic, free flowing. I don't really script any of this stuff. We just come in like.
Right. I didn't know what we were talking about really.
No.
I've heard other episodes. I just was listening to your Chase Miller episode and I figured that we're just going to talk.
Yeah.
About the confessions of a street broker.
The confessions. So let's get in, let's dive into that.
Let's confess.
So let's just start. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from?
Yep. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. I'm from here. East Dallas in the Lakewood area. I went to Lakewood, J.L. Long Middle School, Woodrow Wilson High School.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a pretty cool experience and had like all the same group of friends the whole way up. You were kind of similar, weren't you,
in Irving? Irving High. Grew up. Still hanging out with a lot of those.
You're on the west side. I was on the east side, similar public school, quite diverse. I was pretty awkward in middle school and I got like picked on a lot and there were a lot of like, you know, gangs going on and people getting jumped in and out of gangs. So that was entertaining.
Yep.
Created some childhood trauma. Then at Woodrow, all of the gangsters in middle school, they just stayed in middle school for as long as possible. So they were like 16 with beards when I was like 13 years old or something.
It sounds a lot like Crockett Junior High in Irving.
Yeah. It's not pleasant, but it was also like rite of passage.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone the other day and they were talking about like carrying a gun and they're like, yeah, man, I carry a gun on me and I'm going to go like be ready to shoot if someone's coming after me. I'm like, dude, you go to Woodrow, you have a third eye and you just like don't go around people that are like carrying fucking guns. Like I'm not like a gangster.
So yeah.
I'm just like, I want to avoid trouble. I've had a gun put to my head before. I'm like, I look around corners still to this day, like worried about that because of J.L. Long, really.
Yeah.
So then I went to Woodrow. So none, the gangsters basically like just became drug dealers when we got to high school. And then it became much more chill. And that was a great time. And
that's the evolution of a street hustler.
Yeah. So. That's the street. Yeah. That's the school of hard knocks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I went to Brown to play football. I got recruited there to play football.
Okay. So what made you choose Brown? So when you go through recruiting, like, you know, there's a lot of schools and, you know, you don't really know. I feel like there's so much more information now out for kids to understand what recruiting's like and going to a program and all that stuff compared to when I was recruited and versus when you were recruited. Like, so what was it about Brown that made you want to go there?
So I fell into a class of recruits where I got recruited by service academies and Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
which is very strange, the Ivy League school part. I had never heard of Brown. I got questionnaires from everywhere when I was like a junior in high school.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go to UT or A&M or play big time college football.
Yeah.
And thought that I could. I was getting these letters, like handwritten letters from coaches. And then the spring combine, I screwed my shoulder up right before it in spring football.
Yeah.
And just had a horrible showing at the combine, the D1 combine. And then all the big schools totally dropped off. And all the Ivy Leagues just were there.
Yeah.
And I didn't fill out any of the questionnaires, but my mom did. I'm not going to Brown. What are you talking? I never heard of Brown. It's like, is that in Cleveland? I didn't know anything about the Ivy League. I was not a great student at Woodrow. It's like a public school, inner city public school. I took a couple honors classes, but I was in a lot of the regular classes. I wasn't a big fan of doing homework or studying or any of that. So I just scraped by. I made B's and the occasional C's.
Yeah.
I didn't fail anything, I don't think. But anyway, very ironic that all of a sudden I'm being recruited by all the Ivy League schools. And I could have gone to any of them.
Yeah.
The reason I went to Brown is because they don't have a core curriculum. So you can take any classes that you want for your preferred major. And they don't have grades. It's pass fail.
Okay.
I like the football coach. He was Coach Whipple. He was a great guy. He was an incredible coach. I only played my freshman year. I got injured and then I decided to just stay.
Yeah.
The Ivy Leagues, they don't give scholarships. They didn't get a scholarship. They get you in.
Yeah.
There's no way in hell I would have gotten into Brown. I mean, I'm making C's in a Woodrow.
Yeah.
You know, I made 1170 on my SAT. So nothing crazy.
Yeah.
It was just run of the mill.
Right.
And I think I was higher than some of the other football players at Brown, but not very many, you know? It really came down to Brown and Columbia. And then I just looked at it. I liked the vibe of the classroom scenario there. Like, what? You can take everything pass fail and you don't have to take biology or something in freshman year. Let's go. And I didn't, when I got to Brown, I failed my first paper I wrote. I got a no credit on it. I couldn't write. I could write, but I couldn't write a paper like the way they expected you to at an Ivy League school.
Yeah.
So the dean, I had to go to the dean's office and get a writing tutor. So they don't want you to flunk out there. They want their graduation rate to be at 100%. So I got a writing tutor and I wish I remembered her name because I talk about her quite often. Like, what did I learn at Brown? I learned how to write really well because this girl tutored me for the whole first semester of college. And then once I learned how to write, then I could write papers, and I took all sociology classes and political science classes. So, that allowed me a lot of leeway to not go to class and make B's and C's again, but didn't matter because I just got pass or fail. So there you go.
Yeah.
So, what else?
Well, so then you leave Brown and what? You come back to Dallas?
Yeah, I came back to Dallas. I interned in commercial real estate all through college.
Okay.
My dad worked in commercial real estate, still does.
Yeah.
And he plugged me in with a company he used to work for called Dalmac, which is a construction company. They did development too. So I worked there after freshman year. And after sophomore year, I worked at the Staubach company.
Yeah.
Junior year, I worked at Cushman & Wakefield. And then when I graduated, I worked for Faubert Commercial leasing office space.
Okay.
And I did that for about 2.5 years. And during that whole time, when I was a senior in high school, through that time, I played music. That's when I started playing in a band.
Yeah.
So I played in a band all through college. So I'd be interning at the Staubach company and playing shows every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Tuesday nights, over my summer and winter breaks, we played nonstop.
Yeah.
And that went on all through college. And when I got that first job at Faubert, the whole time, all I was doing was trying to get our band Slick 57 signed to a record label.
Yeah.
So I was emailing every record label, mailing, how we used to have to do, mailing the hard press kits.
Yeah.
to every record label in the world that would sign a band that played our kind of music, which was like Americana, alt country, you know, like country punk rock kind of music. It was that we played a pretty unique genre of underground honky tonk music. So I knew every label. I was like, you were, I'm sure too. I was obsessed with all the bands that I listened to. I read all the liner notes. I knew who everybody's record label was. I knew who all the contacts were, made a list, cold called them nonstop. And then after like 2 years at Faubert, we played at South by Southwest and got signed to this Australian record label called Laughing Outlaw Records. And they gave us like, I think a deal that was probably worth like $20,000 or something.
Yeah.
And that included a plane ticket and to Australia and a 30-day tour there. So I set up where we had a layover for a month in Europe and with our plane tickets. And then John Pettigo, my bandmate, and I, we booked the 30-day tour in Europe ourselves by cold calling.
Just venues.
And all the venues in Europe that all the bands we liked were playing at in Europe.
Yeah.
And our kind of music was really big in Europe. It was all debatably more popular there than over here.
Okay.
They just loved the Texas kind of music, you know? Mm-hmm. So I knew all the venues. So we cold called them, booked that tour. And then I quit my job at Faubert October of 2002 and went on the road. So we just went to Europe for a month, Australia for a month, went to New Zealand. And then we came back here and we booked all of our shows in the US and we played 200 shows a year for 4 years. And that's when I met you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So rehearsing.
Yeah.
At your Universal Rehearsal.
Well, it's pro rehearsal. It used
It was pro rehearsal.
Yeah. So when I got that, I started coming in early to like kind of start getting things together. I was like, man, I got to like turn this place around. Da, 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 da. And I walk in one morning about 8 a.m. and there's this guy sleeping on my couch in the lobby. It's you. And I'm like,
I don't remember this.
They're looking at me. I was like, hey, man. You're like, huh? And we start talking. And I don't know how we got on it, but I was like, so where are you from? And you told me. And we just started talking. And you told me you were Jacob's. And then somehow we got to the point that you were Jacob's cousin. I was like, well, I know Jacob. And I go, you know Todd? You know Zach May? You know all these guys?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So it's kind of instantly connected there. And then it really turned out we were actually in rehearsal rooms next to each other because you were rehearsing with the Von Erichs. And I was in I think that was room 35 or 36. And I was in 34 or 35 right next to you.
I remember right where I was. I guess so, like draw a map.
Yeah. It's like right down that little hallway in the very back in the dead end. And
it was a good place.
Jason
Vandegrift negotiated a good spot there.
He did. He was
subleasing to us illegally.
Yeah. So you weren't allowed to sublease in my lease, but I ended up permitting it for you because you ended up having the Brownwood connection that with all my friends. So I was like, okay, well, Jason's a great guy. Okay, you're cool. And y'all were actually really hardworking bands too. That was one thing when I was running that place. I was like, if you were like the weekend warrior guys that, you know, some guys golf, some guys still play music, right? And so those guys, I'm like, hey, man, you need to like pay rent, pay, you know, you need, this is a hobby, right?
Pay extra rent.
Yeah. You know, you need to make it up for these guys over here. You know, but I mean, like, you know, Jason and them were touring hardcore nonstop.
We toured together quite often.
You know, so
those tours were so crazy, man.
And that's what I was trying to do at that time too, is like, you know, I want to get to this point of just playing constantly. And so that's, I always gave a little grace to those people that were actually working. If you were just hanging out, smoking dope or whatever, and not really doing anything with, you know, if you're the band that's been writing the same album for 5 years, I'm kind of like, okay, this isn't a real band. This is a hobby, you know? And so, you know, but it's interesting. I don't think anybody can really understand. Especially, you know, I would think like in the business world, some people kind of look at a band like, oh, that's just a bunch of rocker dudes. But a band is a very unique dynamic, right? You usually have one guy that's doing everything, one guy that does absolutely nothing, one guy that has a substance abuse problem, and one guy that's habitually late. And so...
Literally.
Yeah. It sounds like you were the guy that does everything, right? So I don't think
I might be all the above, but I was never late.
Well, you know, the thing is,
I did not do nothing. I mean, I did everything. We all had substance abuse problems. I mean, we played in a honky tonk band.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, who doesn't?
Right. Well, I don't think it matters what genre it is. They all have issues. Because I was in the metal scene and there's a lot of stuff. But I think what a band taught me a lot of was like, I got a show. I got to go more. You know, I was down in Deep Ellum flyering clubs. Every Friday and Saturday night, it was like, hey, we got to promote our show. Like, we got to go down there, go to the other like metal shows and promote our metal band to other, you know, people that are listening to that stuff and call the venues, do all these things. And it's a lot more of it's crazy also how I feel like people, they don't think they should really have to pay you for what you're doing in a way. And like, you know, now that, you know, I play a little and stuff like that, and we book stuff, they're like, oh, we'll pay you $500. I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like,
that was a lot back then.
It was a ton back then. I mean, you couldn't even, like, usually you wouldn't even get paid. You would just get a cut of the door of what you drew. And so, but I think doing all those things probably taught you a lot.
Oh, yeah.
How to go into the next phase of life. So you're on tour, you're going at it hard, trying to make it happen. You're on this record label. How did that play out?
So we got sued by the record label for $30,000.
On a $20,000 deal? Yeah.
I guess one cool thing that happened was the first European tour that we booked, when we were over there, we got signed to a European booking agent. So then we started going back to Europe quite often. So we're touring Europe all the time. We're touring the US all the time. We never went back to Australia. The Australians are like, where's the money? And they sued us thinking that we were making shitloads of money because of the cool, we were playing great shows, you know, but like, it's a grind.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're making ends meet.
Yeah.
And we got sued. We settled and no big deal. We got signed to another record label in Europe and put out another album around that time. Like, we booked a tour in Europe, all festival shows, just like my dream come true. And we were getting close to the tour, and then I did the numbers and was like, we're going to break even on this tour. Or if we stay home and play in our other band, The Boys Named Sue, mm-hmm. who were gaining a lot of popularity in Dallas, and we were getting these gigs here playing like House of Blues for $1,500 or something.
Yeah.
Then, so the Sues were kind of making money. I was waiting tables at the All Good Cafe, making money and just being lazy. And we were sick of each other. We'd been on the road for 4 years. And like, I mean, John and I barely spoke at that point. We would just talk about playing shows. It's like, go to Europe for a month and break even, or stay here, make money and not have to deal with being on the road.
Yeah.
So we canceled that tour. And at that point, that's when I was like, okay, this part of my life's over.
Yeah.
If I don't love it, like, I obviously don't love it because I'm not going to play these important shows in Europe. So it's time to move on and do something different.
Yeah. So what year is this when this all kind of...
This was 05 when that tour was supposed to happen. I was 27. And then March of 06, I started working for your brother.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Allen Mercer. And I met him through Todd Hubbard.
Yeah.
And I hung out with Todd quite a bit back then because I hung out with my cousin Tigray all the time, who went to high school with him. And so Todd would come over, and I still had my real estate license the whole time. So when I was in the band, I worked at a call center for residential realtors. I worked at Freebird's Burritos. We lived for months at a time without electricity.
Yeah.
It was just insane. But then anyway, I talked to Todd like, hey, I'd like to, you know, talk about doing industrial, because I'd done office before and I never felt like I fit in, like, with the suits and the fanciness of being in office buildings and being an office broker. I hung out at dive bars and that kind of thing, and I felt more drawn to industrial.
I've always said that I would love to have done office because the fees are great, but I'm not pretty enough to do office.
Correct.
They are like the perfect humans, you know, they're like,
so polished.
They are so polished. And so, anyways,
so then I met your brother. He's a pretty polished human being. Well,
yeah.
You know, he's just like very polished for a street broker.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember meeting him. He's like wearing his suit. It's all ripped up, you know, and like his pinstripe suit, driving a BMW. And like, oh my God, this guy is so down to earth and cool. And just like, this guy is awesome. And he was the only, I think it was the only job I interviewed for is with him. And thankfully he hired me. I was so excited and started at Robert Lynn.
Yeah.
And then I was wearing a suit like every day, Monday through Thursday in the office, what, like seven, probably till six was the requirement.
Yeah.
And started working the system and got trained by the master dude.
Mm-hmm.
On how to go be a street broker.
Yeah.
And worked Brook Hollow, Trinity, did all the Robert Lynn things for 1 year, and then he fired me. He didn't really fire me. He's like, we're no longer going to work together. You can stay here and do your own thing. And like, you don't have to leave, but we're not going to partner anymore. Like,
yeah.
And that's when he was moving to Graham, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. This is awkward. So I stayed there till like August, and then I went to Cushman and Wakefield to be an office broker.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to being an office broker. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like, man, it was just weird to go from touring to go to Robert Lynn, like same, but polar opposites.
Yeah.
Same in that you're working your ass off all the time, but it's just so different. The regimented schedule of waking up super early and being there all day. And it's pretty intense. So then I went to work for Mike Wyatt. Rest in peace. He just passed away last year.
Yeah.
And mental health related.
Yeah.
We just had a deal this last weekend where we all jumped in the cold pool at Northwood.
Yeah.
The Stallion. He called himself the Stallion. And we did a polar plunge. So that was pretty cool. So anyway, Mike was an incredible human being, such a great teacher also.
Yeah.
He really taught me like the value of working for a large company like Cushman and Wakefield. He was very tapped into the whole Cushman and Wakefield network. He had a corporate client that he did deals with everywhere. And then that allowed him to get inbound business from all the Cushman brokers. And I saw how that all worked. And I lasted like August to May working with him. And then at that point in time, I just could not stand working for people is what the deal was, you know? I had learned, Jeff taught me everything I needed to know in the 12 months we worked together. Like, here's how you go, be a real estate broker. And then it was like eight more months of working for another senior level broker, kind of like telling me what time to wake up and what to wear and where to be. And I mean, I was, after running my own business basically for four years, I couldn't take it any longer. So went to Transwestern, where I was like my own man, you know, they're like, here's your desk and phone, go do your thing.
Yeah.
And I loved that. And that I loved the freedom just to go do what I wanted to do. Got back to doing industrial, went back to doing Trinity and Brook Hollow, and was working there with great people, with Brant Landry, Sharon Morrison. They all came over from Staubach Company. Yep. So got to really get exposed to the Staubach way of doing things. So now I've had Jeff Mercer, street broker, Mike Wyatt, like super corporate, Cushman and Wakefield, tenant rep office broker. Mm-hmm. And then I'm with all these badass Staubach industrial brokers, tenant rep industrial brokers that are doing like big time tenant rep in multiple markets across the country.
Yeah.
And I, through a friend of mine from my band days, a bartender at the Barley House, John Schmidt, he and I were talking at the bar at a Slobber Bone concert at the Barley House. And he tells me he's working at a logistics company. I was like, no shit. And so he introduced me, his dad is the CFO.
Yeah.
And they're firing their broker. And I got a meeting with him. And like all those people at Transwestern helped me like prepare for the pitch and everything. It was great. But I went in solo to this pitch, and that was Dynamics.
Yeah.
And they were publicly traded, had 100 facilities in the US and Canada. And he hired me. And so then I went from doing like Brook Hollow Design District overnight, basically, to solo managing 100 facility portfolio, doing lease administration, and then working on deals in all these different cities, doing like 30 deals a year or something. And that's all I did.
Okay.
So, and that was 4 years at Transwestern. Then, like in that fourth year, Dynamics got acquired by a company called Transforce in Montreal. So when that happened, then my golden goose client evaporated, which is what happens when you have one client. So if you're listening, don't just have one client or this will happen and everything can go away. And they were still letting me work renewals and calling. I knew it was their first big U.S. acquisition. They're based in Montreal. So I knew every lease like in my head. I had them memorized. And so I was still working on some stuff, but the flow slowed way down. Dynamics was the type of company that was taking more space than they needed and doing 5-7 year leases or 10 year leases. And then Transforce is like very much like their strategy is to go buy a bunch of companies and then improve efficiencies, do short lease terms, take as little space as possible.
Yeah.
And they want, I mean, just totally different culture, which then you learn about that. Like, okay, that whatever you guys want to do, that's fine. Like I'm going to change my ways to adhere to this new company's culture.
And
I knew them at least. And moved to Colliers though, because I wanted to go pitch Transforce being at a larger company since they were a larger company.
Yeah.
They had 500 facilities instead of 100. And so I wanted to go in there like I'm with a big ass company. So I talked to a few big companies, decided on Colliers and went there in 2012. So 12 years ago.
Yeah.
January, almost exactly. So anyway, then I went there and I partnered up with Chris Teasdale and Tom Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked together for 2 years. During those 2 years, I learned from them too.
Yeah.
So, man, I had so many amazing mentors along the way, like between your brother, Mike Wyatt, the whole Staubach crew. And when I was working with Brant and Sharon, it's like Brad Strucks there, Jim Hazard is there. They're both just, you know, I think two of the best industrial brokers. You got to get all of them on here, by the way.
Yeah.
So then Chris and Tommy taught me about land and development and all of that. And we worked together for 2 years. And then at that point, I was like, I just want to do my thing again. We were on a team. And it wasn't because of them. It was probably because of me.
Mm-hmm.
But in my head, I'm this, at the time, like 35 years old. And they're older than I am. And I was just going to meetings with them. And I felt like I was being viewed as like the young guy on the team.
Yeah.
So my bulletproof ego does not like to be thought of that way. Never has been. So anyway, we parted ways amicably. And still good buddies with them. We all work at Colliers. But then I hired Cole. And I'm like, I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm going to build my own team. And hired Cole. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then we've just... Transforce eventually hired me. So they're still a client. And we do all their U.S. real estate for the most part. And then, you know, the CEO of Dynamics moved to Yellow. So then we got hired at Yellow. And somebody would go to this company, and they're all logistics companies and trucking companies. So then I'd go follow them there. And I just grew organically that way.
Yeah.
Until 2015.
I think the cool thing about what you're talking about, though, is something that I've never experienced, right? I've never really worked for anybody and seen the other side of how things are done. And so that's kind of been very interesting, like here at that Matador now is like, I'm hiring people that have been at larger places. And there's a lot of other perspective that I haven't seen. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the Robert Lynn way, which was pretty much morphed, and that's what Mercer Company adapted. And that's all I really know. But there's such a whole nother way of doing things, kind of how you did it. Now, I think that also depends on what kind of shop you're at, right? Like, you know, to your point, you wanted to move to Colliers because you needed a bigger brand behind you for Transforce to kind of feel comfortable with that you could actually service that account. And so I think,
as a salesperson, I just didn't want any excuses as to why they wouldn't hire me.
Right.
So is that true that I needed the brand? Who knows? But I just wanted every tool in the toolkit possible when I was going into pitch.
I honestly don't think the brokerage you're at really matters.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the execution of anything.
Right.
But I do think optically, when you get in the larger publicly traded, larger people, they can't go say they hired boutique firm over here because it's job security to think like,
That's right.
Why didn't you hire CBRE? Why didn't you hire JLL? Why didn't you hire Colliers? You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, you remove that objection by having that business card in a way. But at the end of the day, it's really your team and y'all's execution and your creativeness on like, this is going to be my niche. You know what I mean? And what an incredible niche it's turned out to be, right? Like, supply chain logistics wasn't that big of a deal when you started doing it.
No.
It was a big deal, but no one talked about it.
It wasn't a buzzword.
Right. Now it's like, it's like iOS, right? Everybody calls things iOS now. Well, that's just shitty metal buildings on 5 acres of land that I've been selling my whole life. But all of a sudden, they're institutionally safe because you put an acronym behind it.
That's right.
You know, so there's a lot of optics that go into this stuff that make because the optics of things is what makes capital flow.
Yeah.
You know,
now I can tell you this, like having at a Colliers, I've got a workforce analytics guy I can call.
Yeah.
Who works at Colliers. He can do labor analytics. I've got a supply chain consultant that used to work at some big at like KPMG or something, some big consulting firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I can bring him to pitches. I've got a whole team who can help me go prepare for a pitch for 200 facilities globally where we're having to deal with leases that are written in foreign languages all around the world.
Yeah.
I have 500 offices so I can go tap experts everywhere. All have the same brand. It's just really cohesive and nice. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that. Like the market, there's multi-levels of marketing support that we get. Like, so there's good things. I mean, there's a reason why these companies are big companies and they have the market share, you know? But I do think at the end of the day, like doing a deal, it's about the broker and the broker's team and like how they're going to execute. But there's all these other layers like technology. We have this technology called Colliers 360 where we plug people's leases in. You can go like look at it in these dashboards. And I know like other small boutique firms build this same technology too. So
yeah.
For me personally, I wouldn't want to start my own company. I think about it sometimes, but to have to go I would want all of these things. And then it's like, gosh, what am I going to be doing if I have to deal with starting my own company and having all of these bells and whistles I'm used to selling and I'm used to having to support my clients? Like that becomes a whole job in and of itself that I don't want to have, frankly.
Well,
I want to have somebody else handing that to me when I need it.
Well, that's, you know, there's a lot of things when you step over to the other side of ownership, you know, it's like you go out and make a living being the broker on this type of stuff, you know, and, you know, what I've had to learn a lot, you know, I was always a lone wolf broker. Like, you know, I was never a good teammate broker. I'll tell you that. Like, I had teammates, but like half the time I'd just be like, just get out of my way. I'll do it. And like, you know, I've had to totally flip that switch with what we're trying to do here at Matador because like we got a lot of assets now and it takes a lot of people to touch these assets and manage the tenants and manage the acquisition and manage the capital and manage just everything so I've had to build a team. And so now I've kind of really switched that role into building a team. So I don't do a ton of sales anymore.
Yeah.
I just kind of build teams now. So, you know, when you do get into the other side of owning your own company, we're doing our own analytics here. You know, we have to do that stuff. So, I mean, that takes a lot of bandwidth versus just going and winning business and executing it.
That's right.
You know? So,
yeah, man. So
now you're supply chain logistics. You got a team with, there's five of y'all?
Six.
Okay. So like, talk about the the evolution of what supply chain has really done, especially since COVID and all that stuff. But like, what have you seen? And then, you know, you deal with all these logistics companies, like what is going on in trucking? I mean, the wave of trucking right now with pricing and all that stuff has gone, it's come back down dramatically, it seems like, but kind of just give us the view on what you see in all that.
Yeah. I mean, basically like Amazon Prime started.
Yeah.
Right. Like when I started doing industrial real estate, basically in 2006, '09 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then that created this new consumer demand for wanting things now.
Yeah.
And wanting things as soon as possible, faster delivery times. Jeff Bezos basically made that happen.
Yeah.
With Amazon. And then everybody started trying to keep up. So that's when the whole industrial real estate just started growing very steadily as e-commerce grew.
Yeah.
And it was like, if you look at an e-commerce chart, there's a steady climb from 0 to 15%. It's just like a straight up line that's going the same vector, I guess you'd call it. And then COVID happened. And then it went from 15% to 22% overnight.
Yeah.
So it just like jumped like it had never jumped before. So when COVID happened, obviously, if you're an industrial broker, you already probably know this, but if you're not, then everybody being locked in their homes by the government made everyone start clicking and ordering e-commerce. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Everybody's working from home and locked in their houses. So they're ordering everything. So then when that occurred, there was this huge surge in demand for products to be shipped via e-commerce. And that created this jam in the supply chain because it wasn't set up to handle that jump. So how did everyone respond to that demand is build and take down as much warehouse space as possible.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in 2020, 21, 22 until, and it got all absorbed until 2023. And then the interest rates happened. And listen, like in 20, I mean, I guess I can note like trucking's exploding, ocean freight's exploding, like the ports are jammed up, everything's jammed up, there's labor shortages. So just like everybody just needs more inventory, more space, more, and there's no more, like everything's jammed up. So they're building these cross-docking facilities for ocean freight, these transload facilities, like everybody's taking these down because the East Coast ports are picking up all this new activity. And the LTL market's exploding. And then that all stopped, like with really it's what it seems like is this, the interest rate hikes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's that or, and it's also e-commerce went back down.
Well, did supply catch up finally? Like, you know, a lot of manufacturers were down during COVID, it seemed like for a while. And then, you know, there was a supply chain issue, but now.
Yeah, then there's extra inventories who's overbought expecting
right.
it. I didn't say that. I mean, I guess I just did, but e-commerce went back down.
Yeah.
And so when that happened, then everybody's like, wait a minute, now I ordered all of this stuff. So nobody knows what they're doing. They're just very reactive. And not everybody doesn't know what they're doing, but it seems to me like it was very reactive, just trying to keep up and get products to the customer, right? But no one knows what to do because it's never happened before.
Well, I mean, to your point, though, like a lot of people didn't know what, Amazon didn't know what they're doing. That's why they put so many spaces up for sublease now, right? I mean, like they really overstepped on real estate after that just because at the time it was like, how do we account for this?
Beg for forgiveness later, basically. Everyone.
Yeah. So
now ocean freight has cooled, but now ocean freight's all screwed up because the Panama Canal is experiencing a drought. There's pirates in the Caribbean. Yeah. What the fuck's going on? I mean, I don't know what's happening, but there's like ships getting robbed by pirates, literally. So now ocean freight's like all jammed up. Air freight's going through the roof right now because they don't want to be in the ocean.
Yeah.
And that also happened during COVID. Air freight rates jumped. Trucking is still in a recession. I'm going to this great conference in a couple of weeks, so I will have to do an update. I'll have to call you and tell you what's going on, but that it's a good supply chain conference where I look forward to hearing. But from what I can tell, everybody is being very conservative right now in general on industrial, taking down industrial real estate. They're doing what they need to do, but there's not a lot of CapEx. There's a lot of pressure because all of these companies and leaders of these companies looked like rock stars because of what happened during COVID. And then when this all stopped, it's like, why don't we have the same growth that we were having? And it's because it's the cyclical nature of the economy and the logistics business, especially.
Yeah.
And so, companies are cutting CapEx left and right now, as far as I can tell, and they're doing deals if they make really good sense. But these big speculative bets that were occurring on tenants taking more space, I don't see that happening. There's a softening of the trucking market. Now, simultaneously, I do a lot of work in Mexico. So nearshoring mm-hmm. in Mexico is exploding. I just did a presentation on this. I don't remember any of the stats, but it's exploding. That's my stat. companies are moving, a lot of Chinese companies are moving to Mexico to do their manufacturing there, to be closer to the US because the labor supply, the amount of labor and the cost of labor and the nearness to the United States.
So in the nearshoring stuff, we buy in San Antonio, we have glanced at Laredo, but just from everybody literally tells us that Laredo is controlled by like two people and, I don't know.
Majestic's there.
So I guess, and then I looked at McAllen Farr.
I sold Exeter, a FedEx building in Laredo, actually.
Okay. Well, so, but for nearshoring to grow in those markets. So I looked down and I got a real good buddy of mine, teammate of mine from college. And he was like, he lives in McAllen. He's like, hey man, I could be your boots on the ground down here, but this is going to happen down here in the Rio Grande Valley. And I don't develop.
That's more like cross-border freight is what you're talking about.
Okay.
Versus nearshoring in actual Mexico.
Yeah.
Because it's not reshoring, which is, I believe, means U.S. manufacturing coming here.
Okay.
And the nearshoring to Mexico. Or okay. Costa Rica, or like anywhere close to the U.S.
What does nearshoring mean?
Nearshoring means not in the United States, but near to the United States.
Okay, so on the other side of the border in Mexico, essentially.
South of here, basically.
Yeah.
Like anywhere in LATAM could be considered that, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm no expert. That's driving a huge amount of 3PL activity in Mexico to support all these manufacturing facilities going to Mexico.
Yeah.
Then reshoring is manufacturing facilities coming to the United States and just coming here to
set shop up.
The good old USA. Yeah, set shop up. And then, what you're talking about is like Laredo and El Paso and Harlingen and all these like more border markets.
Yeah.
And then that's like this cross-border trade where they're bringing stuff over and it's more like cross-docking type spaces there.
Okay.
Where the spaces in Mexico are like 200,000 to 400,000 square foot distribution centers that 3PLs are taking down to support these big manufacturing facilities that are doing like electronic components, automotive components mainly. I think those are the top two.
What does it cost to build a building in Mexico? Do you know?
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. I think it just depends on the market and everything.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's pretty
comparable.
Pretty close to here.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rates there are, they're higher than here. I just have a presentation on my phone, but I don't even want to talk about the rates, but I'm going to put it on my website.
Okay.
supplychainrealestate.com. I'm going to put that whole presentation there on this nearshoring, and it'll have all the Mexico rates and all the markets there.
I don't think I'm going to Mexico, but I don't think I could figure it out. I
think there's opportunity to be had there. And from an investment perspective, I like to go there as a tenant rep broker and just, I have a great teammate who's in Juarez, and so he quarterbacks all of our deals in Mexico, mm-hmm. but we put our team's processes in place so that we can go down there and really bring a new, what I like to think, level of detail
yeah.
to transactions representing yeah. tenants in Mexico. So I like it. And our team down there is awesome. Another great thing. I mean, you can go find brokers, no matter if you're at your own company, but Colliers has a great Mexico team. And
yeah,
that has become a selling point. And we're getting in the door with a lot of companies by just starting in Mexico.
Yeah.
Like if you you got your broker here, that's fine. Just give us Mexico.
Yeah.
And then you get in Mexico. And by the way, if you can handle Mexico, you can handle anything. Yeah. Mexico and 3PLs at the same time. Like, try to fuck with me, anybody. Yeah. Like, you can't.
I got one 3PL client, man, and it's a tough deal for them. I mean, they're grinders, man. They grind every deal point down, and but you know, that's their business. There's a lot, and there's thin margins in it, I guess. And so, but well. So what do you think outlook for 24 is, though? You think it's
unpredictable?
Unpredictable?
I don't know. I think it'll be fine. Hopefully these spaces get leased.
Yeah.
I think the construction's stopping.
Yeah.
And
I mean, are we overbuilt? Do you think we're overbuilt right now?
Dallas is.
Yeah.
In South Dallas and like certain pockets. You know, it just depends on where. If you're like by the airport, I don't think so.
Right.
But like, I think LA is struggling right now. I've heard like LA, they're cutting major deals, like really? Dropping rents 50% in some places.
Wow.
The Inland Empire. Summit Hogue told me that.
Well, he would know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I just think a lot of markets have low levels of activity right now on the leasing side, but I don't think Dallas does. I think Dallas could have oversupply, but I feel like our activity is pretty damn good.
So if we just stop building, it'll all get absorbed.
I'm hoping like DFW, like we absorb this space eventually this year, and you know, construction numbers, what they were like 80 million square foot under construction. Now it's 50, and I think it's hanging around 50, but then I bet hopefully by the end of the year, it's down to like 25.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then we've got a very healthy market and the election's over and people don't like to make decisions in an election year. Interest rate hikes, they're promising that they're going to lower. So let's see that happen. And then that, I think that is going to open up buying power for tenants that right now have their hands tied because the boards are saying, cut your CapEx down right now because of this economic uncertainty.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we need to do an update one on that.
Yeah.
Because you got a lot of global info that a lot of other brokers I talk with don't. So, well, let me go back to just a couple of things with your brokerage stuff or just, you know, kind of what it takes to win in brokerage, you know? I think there's, you know, what are kind of the things that you feel that you've done that are like your ritualistic things that's like, you know, these are the one things I always do and this is what always works for me?
Yeah. I was going to go back to like 2016 is when I hired Cole in 2014. And then 2016, I hired Reagan Dixon as my coach. And he helped me really get a good plan of attack in place. Because at that point in time, I was saying like, I had won my one client, then they got acquired. I won them, the acquirer.
Yeah.
And then the CEO moved to another company. I won him. So it was this organic growth. But in 2016, I hired Reagan. He's like, you need to focus on and make cold calls. Cause I'd stopped making cold calls like back when I got hired by Dynamics in like 2009. So it's now 2016. So I hadn't made a cold call since 2009.
Yeah.
And I didn't even remember. I didn't know how to make cold calls the way, like, because I wasn't going back to Brook Hollow to make cold calls.
Right.
Like, so now I'm calling on the top 50 logistics companies in the world. And that's, I worked with Reagan. I said, like, here's who I'm going to call on. And anyway, I made that list, but I didn't know how to call on them.
Yeah.
It's funny. Like, I didn't know what to do. So I Googled YouTube, like, how to make a cold call. So funny.
Yeah.
And like, this is after like two record years of my career, like, just having an incredible business going, I'm like, how the fuck do you make a cold call like to these people? It's not the same as the Robert Lynn method because I'm not doing submarket specialization. Like, I could still go make those cold calls, but that's not what I'm selling.
Yeah.
And so I watched a YouTube video, and then I started reading self-help books like crazy.
Yeah.
And I started hiring coaches and learned how to do that. But the main thing to answer your question is specialize in something.
Yeah.
And then be very thoughtful about the value you create to the people that you're selling to.
Yeah.
So if you are working the Robert Lynn model and you're doing Brook Hollow, then you're selling submarket specialization. And that's
knowledge.
What you
go say, the knowledge.
I know this submarket.
Yeah.
I basically sell, I know 3PLs. I know logistics. Because all I do, I know every player in that. And then that kind of opens me up to any shippers also, because I know the 3PLs, they're doing all the shipping for the shippers. So I know the supply chain. But really, then doing 3PL real estate is a different kind of real estate than doing shipper real estate, which they're not doing. It's just a very different type of business.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how to sell both, though. So I can go meet with a shipper and say, here's how we do it.
Yeah.
I basically say, like I said earlier, I represent all these giant 3PLs. And if you can do that, then doing shipper real estate is nothing.
Yeah.
So like once you go, I've got a Harvard PhD in doing industrial real estate because I rep all these giant 3PLs. So it really becomes much easier to me to work with a shipper because they aren't quite as reactive. They're a little more proactive. They're a little more stability in their portfolio.
Yeah.
Whereas 3PLs are just trying to chase as many shippers as possible. They're like us, you know, like just running around trying to grow the business. Not really like us. They're just like 3PLs. But anyway, specialize in something and then to create that value proposition, like what are you going to do? So I got really clear on it. Like I work with large users of industrial real estate that have lots of locations.
Yeah.
That's where I can really create value.
Yeah.
And I know Tyson Irwin and Robert Lynn works the airport. He knows the airport cold.
Yeah.
Todd Hubbard, Fort Worth. Like I love Robert Lynn always because of what I learned there. So and I always think of these guys.
Yeah.
But I know those guys in every market in North America.
Yeah.
Like in every submarket in North America. Like on my cell phone, speed dial, I've done 20 deals with them. So that's I sell that.
Yeah.
Like and we do deals with them every year, every broker, every market in North America. So that becomes this whole new thing to sell.
Yeah.
And then I call that list over and over and over. And then, I get my teammates to expand the list.
Yeah.
And go focus. Like we're now focused on nearshoring and reshoring.
Yeah.
Because I think that manufacturing is going to start to take down more real estate than distribution, not more than distribution, but more than manufacturing has been. And it's going to create more of a balance between distribution and manufacturing. But there's going to be a big uptick in manufacturing in the U.S. and Mexico, especially where we're doing, and we work in Canada a lot too, but the U.S. and Mexico is going to see this manufacturing. So I want to be on top of that.
Yeah.
These manufacturers are coming here. The 3PLs are still going to play an important role, but I want to get in on this manufacturing business. So we're really building that. But I'm not personally going and doing it, but I'm getting teammates on my team. Like, you go know this cold, and that needs to be what your job is to understand this business. But it's understanding, being specific about who you're calling on, then simplifies it and do the same thing.
Yeah.
Do tenant rep or do landlord rep. Don't do both.
Yeah.
I read a book that my colleague in Seattle, Matt McGregor, wrote, and it's on agency leasing, and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
Hearing all the things that he does to do agency leasing. Like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And there's so many things that you get to learn by specializing in something.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's for anybody that's starting brokerage or, at a point in brokerage, you need to pick something and be the master at it. I think that's what my success was I knew Brook Hollow cold. Like, I always felt that when I went in and pitched someone, they might not even have liked me, but once they heard me talk, they're like, man, I don't know if I could, once they could hear about the knowledge that I had, they're like, I might lose if I don't hire this guy.
That's right.
So that's great. Well,
and you don't have to reinvent the wheel either. No. Once you built the wheel, then we can take on a new account with 100 facilities in their portfolio and no problem. Like, I don't have to think about it. Like, we have a system, we have processes, you're going to go in there.
Yeah.
If I were to go, like, get 10 listings in Dallas by from Prologis to go lease, I'd be like, what are we going to do? We need to have, like, extra 10 hours of meetings per week to get this shit figured out, how we're going to go support this, because we just, that's not what we do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you talked about a bunch of books. What's kind of the most impactful book you read?
I see up there, you have Tools of Titans.
That's a pretty good one.
That's really good.
Yeah.
My current favorite book is The Tao Te Ching.
Okay.
Ever heard of that?
No.
Mm-hmm. It's recommended by multiple people in Tools of Titans.
Is that the one you post on every day that you're reading in? Okay. I read your posts in it. So I guess I'm kind of reading it every day. So
it's really good.
Yeah.
It has just like, it's written by this guy named Lao Tzu.
Yeah.
Who was, I think, 400 years BC, a Chinese. Like, he's like a Zen master, Taoist, and it's just these thoughtful things that seem so applicable to everyday life, just to like look, you know, just looking at life and getting out of your head and just being content that we all have the things that God provides us with, the things that we need, and like the worrying and all of that, that I've struggled with a lot in throughout my life. Like, this thing just brings me peace. I'd read one page of it each morning, and it's just amazing, this shift that it makes in my mood. And then I can like go back to it. And it's just pure wisdom.
You know, it's interesting how that's from 400. So that's 2,400 years old, right? You know?
Yeah.
Times change, things change, but principles kind of remain the same, right? They don't really...
Should I read the one I posted today?
Yeah, read it.
I think I should, because it's pretty quick. Let's see. If a country is governed with tolerance, the people are comfortable and honest. If a country is governed with repression, the people are depressed and crafty. When the will to power is in charge, the higher the ideals, the lower the results. Try to make people happy, and you lay the groundwork for misery. Try to make people moral, and you lay the groundwork for vice. Thus the master is content to serve as an example and not to impose her will. She is pointed but doesn't pierce, straightforward but supple, radiant but easy on the eyes. Just like, this guy. How do you write like that?
I don't know.
So good.
Mm-hmm. He was very focused. There was no iPhone to distract him. He was just locked in on writing that out. So
they don't really know. They're like, when you read the foreword to the book, this is translated from, you know, like
scrolls.
Mandarin and scrolls or something, and by this guy named Stephen Mitchell. But they're like, supposedly this was written by this one guy, Lao Tzu, and supposedly some people think he was a monk that lived in a cave, and some people say that he was like an emperor or something. Like, that no one knows like who he is or where this came from.
But that's funny.
It's fun.
Well, let's touch on one other thing.
Yeah.
You're fixing to play a show again, aren't you?
Tonight.
Tonight?
Yeah.
Oh, are you at?
The All Good Cafe.
All Good Cafe. Back where it all began.
It is. Man, Mike Snyder, who owns that place, he saved my ass back in the Slick 57 days, because I was working at Freebirds and at this cold calling place.
Yeah.
I had to make 150 cold calls an hour or something. Hi, I work for Jeremy Mercer with Remax. Are you considering buying or selling a home in the next 30 days? Dude, I would go from Freebirds, and I would see like office tenant rep, like office leasing people that I worked with previously in commercial real estate.
Yeah.
And I'm like rolling burritos at Freebirds. Like, this guy, this manager who's like 25 years old from College Station, it's like, roll faster, roll faster. It's like, I was cooking meat and chicken and then going to the cold calling place. And then I worked in a moving company. And Mike Snyder is a big music promoter for Americana Music in Dallas. And he called me. It's like, hey, man, I need an expediter up at the All Good Cafe. And he hired me. And then I quit all those jobs and just worked for him the rest of my time touring, which is quite possibly my favorite job. But it's his 30-year anniversary of booking his first show.
Yeah.
And I'm playing it's Song Swap. So it's not a real, I mean, I guess it's a real show. I'm swapping songs with my buddy, John Pettigo, who I mentioned. And I realized that 30 years ago in 1994, we wrote our first song together when we were in high school. So it's our 30-year anniversary. Wow. That's pretty cool how it happened, you know?
So y'all just playing acoustic?
Yeah, we're just like trading songs on acoustic.
That's awesome.
They have, when you hear this, the show will be long gone. So
yeah.
You should go by there and have a chicken fried steak sometime though.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't played a show in 2.5 years, so.
I played like 3 shows last year. We kind of really fell off. And so we've got one booked in April now. And so we're trying to get everybody just coordinated to practice, you know, right. It's like, God, it's so hard, you know,
it's hard.
So, but I love it.
Are good. Your voice is surprisingly stellar.
Oh, thank you.
I heard it like, dude, you can go get like, you need to move to Nashville and do this there. Go take Matador to Nashville.
Yeah. It's fun.
Powerful
man.
Voice.
I
Jimmy too.
Yeah. Jimmy's great. And, it's fun. We really enjoy it, man. I want to find a way to do more of it. I was almost thinking like, do I need to like eventually, you know, we're adding Houston to the mix this year to start buying buildings. And I'm like, man, can I just get like on a tour circuit just in the cities I buy stuff?
Can you sing something a cappella for the listeners right now?
Put me on the spot, man. So what do you want me to sing? I'll sing something for you.
I'm trying to think of you used to have some good cover song that I like.
Let me see. Isabella, do you have any ideas? Oh, yeah. We'll just throw some TJ on there.
Yeah, let's do that.
We are going to start doing some acoustic stuff. I'm going to start doing just a ton of acoustic videos to put out of me singing and just playing songs. Whatever it is, I'm going to start playing more acoustic shows or whatever. Like, I just want to play more music in my life. My son's starting to, this is something really cool.
Your son looks like a little rock star.
He's a stud. He's
got the hair.
He does, man.
Hopefully he doesn't get your jeans. No. <man. laughs> He's going to be depressed if he loses that hair.
Hold on. New Year's Eve, we went to some friend's house and, me and him had never played together.
Yeah.
And I sat down, started playing, singing some songs, and we just started swapping, handing each other the guitar, and he would play a full song, and I would play a full song, and I was like, dude, you have a full set.
Yeah.
Like, you're 15. You can go play. You could go play somewhere with this.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
that's really cool.
And so, you know, it's funny. Our life is, you know, all centered around football and stuff like that. But I'm like, dude, I'm going to tell you what right now. This lasts forever. You know, pretty much.
Way cooler.
So, you know, focus on this. So he plays every night, man. He's
my daughter and I, she helps me write lyrics. She's an incredible little lyricist and she's 9. So,
you
need to get her to play something.
You got to capture them while they want to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
If you miss that window, well, you miss it. My daughter is a phenomenal piano player.
Yeah.
And I kind of missed like fostering that, and I tried to get her the other day. I was like, hey, you've kind of stopped playing piano a little bit. She's like, yeah, I think I'm done. I'm like, God, she's amazing. I'm like, you need to keep doing this because I play a lot at the house. But I'm like, man, I might have missed that. And I thought I missed that with my son in music because he was a drummer, but then he came back around to it.
Yeah, so. That's I think, like, you know, if it's like being an alcoholic, if you don't want to quit, nobody else going to make you quit.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't want to play an instrument, like the only way you're going to get good at playing an instrument is play. I was forced to take piano lessons as a kid and I hated it.
Yeah.
But then when I saw my buddy's band play in high school, like, I want to do that. I bought a bass, like 4 strings. I can figure this shit out.
Yeah.
And I did. And they want to do it, they'll do it.
But yeah. No.
Showing him how fun it is. I mean, they know how much I love it. And like, we play and she helps me write songs. Like, when they'll click, they'll hopefully want to go do it.
Well, another just industrial real estate secret tied to music is, you know, our band Trinity Junction. One of the main songwriters is actually Todd Hubbard.
He told me that. I did not know he was a covert songwriter.
It's funny. Our band is, you know, me and Jimmy and Jimmy's brother, and then 2 guys that, you know, one of them was the first guy I met when I opened the studio. And all the music is written by Todd, and then one of our other best friends from Irving.
Yeah.
And like, it's funny, we started this band and like Todd and him both kind of showed up and were like, hey, here's some songs. And these guys had like 70 fucking songs each.
Really?
That they'd written, which was their therapy for, you know, whatever trauma they had in their life. And like, they're phenomenal lyricists. Like, so it's great. Like, we don't write any lyrics.
Yeah.
All the lyrics are written by them.
Yeah.
So we take the lyrics, we throw riffs to it. Like, we'll go out to Todd's Lake House, me and Micah, the other guy, and Jimmy, and we'll go out there. We'll sit down one night and we'll bang out like five songs. Be like, hey, I got these five riffs. Which song do you have for
it? I want to go to the Lake House. Like, I want an invite. I want an invite.
I asked Todd. It took me a while to get one, even though we're so tidy, but he finally gave me one.
Yeah, I haven't asked him yet.
So, but well, let's wrap this up here.
Yeah, brother. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you for coming. This was really good. I want to do this again too, just cause I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface on things to talk about that were common interest.
I have an answer is you come on trucking on.
Well,
then we just do another one and then I'll come back here and then you come back there.
Yeah. No, we just bounce back and forth. Or if you want to do your trucking on here for me, we can do that too.
Yeah. So, that would be great.
Yeah. So, but no, thanks for coming on. Tell everybody where you're at. You're all over the internet, but like, what's the best way to get at you?
Yeah. You can go to supplychainrealestate.com. You can go to LinkedIn, Ward Richmond, Instagram, Ward214TX.
And
truckinon.com.
And then book another show.
All kinds of shit.
Book another show so everyone can come.
Yeah, I need
and
to
good
do
luck
that.
Tonight.
I'm working on a new album right now, so maybe when that comes out, I'll play a show.
There you go. All right, man.
Cool, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See ya.